Welcome to the International Schools Podcast, where we discuss all aspects of technology and life in international schools, with new episodes live every 2 weeks. This podcast is sponsored by Apps Events. We're a Google for Education partner and active since the launch of Google Apps for Education in 2006. We're a team of former educators and all experts in helping schools integrate Google into their schools and their classrooms. All training is customized for each school, and we make sure it has a lasting impact. Literally thousands of educators worldwide have earned their Google Educator certification with us, with our certification boot camps, and these take place every month and get your staff certified quickly. We also host Google Summits, which are fun, two-day conference-style events with concurrent sessions and keynotes delivered by experienced Google trainers, teaching on a broad range of topics using G Suite both in the classroom and in the school. Check it out over at appsevents.com, and we can bring any of these events to your school, which is an amazing way to build a Google community amongst your staff to support each other, plus to increase the profile of yourself and your school. The podcast is also brought to you by Acer for Education. People ask us what Chromebooks we recommend for schools, and after trying them all, quite literally, we always recommend Acer. We've been to Acer headquarters in Taiwan to be part of product discussions, and they're genuinely the best thought out, most cost-effective, and most importantly, durable devices out there. They're always innovating, including the first tablet running Chrome and the first convertible touchscreen Chromebook. The latest version of this is a Spin 11, which has a stylus and two cameras, and we highly, highly recommend it for schools. They, of course, have a full range of Windows laptops, and for esports fans, their Predator range is second to none. If you'd like more information, please just leave your email over at gg.gg/Acer Education. That's gg.gg/Acer Education, and we'll get right back to you. And now, on to the interview.
And we're live. Hi, welcome everybody watching. I want to introduce you to Dan Taylor from Apps Events.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here. We've got a live episode of the International Schools Podcast, which we're doing using YouTube Live. It's a great tool, by the way. And we're using, just a bit of behind the scenes, we're using a tool called StreamYard to stream the event. Take off my screen. So we've got some returning guests. This is our third episode we've recorded about international school closures and focusing on Asia and the Middle East. And we've got Jason Regan, who's from South Korea. We've got Tim Evans from Hong Kong. We've got James Sayer, who's a teacher and also runs Apps Events in Asia. So he's based in Bangkok. And we've got Nicole Nutzling, who's based in Bahrain in the Middle East. So all these guys work for international schools and have had different experiences in the closures and everything. So great to have you back, guys, and good to be on a live episode. Hopefully we'll get a few live questions. I want to just talk about just a bit of a recap first in terms of what you guys' experience was about a closure and how you handled it. I don't know if you want to start off, James, talk a bit about in Thailand, like how did it go with you with the clothes and
it's funny you should ask that, because we're very lucky in the school system I work in. We were actually just approaching our summer holidays when schools started closing down, so we reached the end of our year and then schools closed within the school system I'm at. The international schools in Bangkok closed probably 2 to 3 weeks just after schools in Hong Kong, so we're fairly quick on the cycle there, I think closely following Hong Kong and Korea. I don't know if people know, Thailand is a top tourist destination for Chinese tourists. So we had a huge number of cases right initially, very, very soon after Hong Kong. And so the international schools were closing down very quickly. Luckily for Thailand, the Thai schools are all closed right now for the summer, and they're due to open back up in June or July. So 90% of schools won't be opening up until then. So they have it pretty easy.
Now, with Thai schools, actually, because James, you weren't on a previous podcast. Thailand's had a history of school closures for, you know, flooding, civil unrest, different things happening. Does that mean are schools better prepared? Do they have more of a plan in terms of closing so they can close quickly and do things online?
Yeah, Tim and I were talking about this before as well. Thailand, Philippines, a lot of countries in Asia are used, unfortunately, to natural disaster. And they've been closing for flooding in Thailand, volcanoes in Philippines, typhoons, so on and so on. They're quite used to these closures and extended closures. So when I hit Thailand, it was very much a case of, we've been here before. We're going to just deal with this the same way we've dealt with all of the others. We'll close down and we'll gradually figure out how we can get the learning out to the students. Don't know if people remember, I think it was 2011, 2012. We were closed for 2 months for flooding, massive floods all came through Bangkok, which closed everything down. And schools dealt with it as they do across most of Asia. So there's not a...
It's not
a dissimilar situation to what we faced before.
But I think the thing is now, though, James, like the kind of recent, you know, the things like Google Meet and Zoom and a lot of these tools have only really sort of got really, really, I'd say, at a very useful level in probably in the last couple of years. So did schools, during these closures, have any kind of online teaching strategy, or was it just a case of closing and delivering work in a kind of more traditional way?
Yeah, that is a big difference. When they closed before, maybe 8-9 years ago, they would look to deliver learning in some way, some kind of asynchronous task. Obviously, with Google Meet, Zoom, Skype, now classes can be delivered fully online. Yeah. And actually, unique to Thailand, I suspect other countries have it as well. They actually have a number of digital TV channels set aside for learning.
Yeah.
So these are channels which are already running live constantly with digital learning. Because you got to remember, outside of Bangkok and Phuket and Chiang Mai, the schools do, you know, students don't have access to devices or internet in the same way that schools in Bangkok do. And so they have these digital TV channels to deliver that learning in a slightly different way.
Great. Interesting. So I don't know, if should we go for Tim, Jason, and then Nicole? I mean, do you want to just give a quick recap of what happened with you in the closing and kind of at a high level, how you dealt with it?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Dan. So here in Hong Kong, it was the end of January when things, there was always people starting to talk, this could potentially be school closures because what had happened over the border. And then it was actually the very first week of February, the government closed the schools down. As a school then, we actually had some experience back in November because there had been some protests which forced schools to close. So that was almost a blessing in disguise looking back, that we had 2 or 3 days there of online learning, and we did have some challenges, but then we could address them in the meantime. And then when we started in February, then we could look at practice from before Christmas and then actually integrate that then. And we've been closed ever since. Potentially we're going to open in the next 3-4 weeks maybe. We had no cases yesterday, and we've had a few days like that now in the last week. So I think the government, as we speak, probably a meeting to discuss next steps then.
And you were using Google tools pretty extensively beforehand, so you were saying, like, yeah, you know, your theory was the best disaster strategies to use the system you're already using, and you were using Google Classroom, and we're using Meet already, or just Classroom?
Yeah, it was. We've always been using the Google tools where possible. Anybody who I've spoken to, I've always said, look at the tools that you're currently using, and try and use them to the best of their ability. It's a challenge integrating new tools in school on campus, and as it is, then to have to manage that remotely with usernames, passwords, troubleshoot things then remotely is a massive, massive challenge. And where possible, we try to avoid it. And we just stuck then Google Classroom. Everything's integrated. It's the one username. It's the one password for students and also parents. Something at the very beginning I didn't think of is actually that the parents are having to support this, especially the younger students, so much. So we've offered sessions to help them and videos and how-to guides as well. But we've kept everything where possible going through Google Classroom. But then a few tools then that integrate in the back end, like Edpuzzle, Screencastify, things like that then.
Yeah, and you were using, what were you using for your younger grades?
So the younger grades, we've always been using Seesaw.
Seesaw, yeah.
So again, this is because of the protests. We decided to bring Google Classroom down to grade 2, where we were only really looking at grade 5. We brought it down to grade 2 because of what happened in November, and that then has made things a lot easier. Then we've got the younger students still on Seesaw then.
Right. Great. Jason, do you want to go through your experience?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Dan, for having me back again. It's great to see you guys again. And actually, we sort of mirrored or followed a lot like what Tim has discussed in Hong Kong, but was in a much more compressed timeline. So where my school's located is kind of away from Seoul, and we had one case back in February. And so they shut down all the schools for 1 week just to make sure everything was, you know, calm and cool. And then they opened back up for 1 week, and then we shut down, and we've been shut down ever since. And so we actually had a 1 week period where we were back at school. And so we were actually able to kind of debrief and decompress and talk about these things. And it was fresh in everyone's mind. And so then we all knew there was a possibility of going back to being closed. And so once we did go back, everybody was much more comfortable. So having that 1 week back on campus was fantastic, because it did give us that time to review and to think about what we should do. But I'll echo what you guys were all saying, is that we stuck with what we knew. You know, we stuck with the tools that we've been using. We have Seesaw on the lower school, and then from sixth grade up, it's all Google Classroom. And we've actually been using more Zoom, but more and more people are using more Meet, Google Meet, because
of a couple of things there, Jason. First of all, Zoom, like, why did you choose Zoom, or whoever chose it? Like, what was the reason to choose Zoom over Meet? I'm curious.
Well, we closed so early compared to a lot of the other parts of the world that a lot of the Meet features hadn't been rolled out yet. It wasn't as secure, I think, was the main thing. I think they like the waiting room. That was one thing, the password, and then the breakout rooms. The breakout rooms are probably the thing that has saved us from just saying, oh, no, we're going to go back over here, is having that ability to pop in and out of small groups. Simulates a classroom environment, right? So you can assign them, or you can have them manually, you know, automatically mixed. So those have been sort of the things that we've enjoyed. And also just things like the gallery view, being able to see everybody at one time, which now is available in Meet, but it wasn't a few weeks ago even, you know. So I think that was probably it, was we were in a hurry to, and a lot of our parents are in the business world, and they're used to using Meet. And so I think for them, it was an easier ecosystem at home to run that through. But we've had to put some major security things in place because of, you know, people showing up that aren't supposed to be there and things like that.
I'm curious. Like, is that something people talk about, Zoom bombing? People tell
Zoom
you.
Bombing,
does that happen? Does that happen to all of you guys? And what kind of experience have you had with that?
Yeah, well, it hadn't happened to me.
But a lot about security flaws in Zoom last week.
Yeah, it didn't happen to me, but it happened to a few people in our school. But part of that was that they hadn't, they weren't informed of all the security features they should use and the protocols. And so for them, it was the unfamiliarity of doing it.
So can you explain what happens with Zoom bombing and how do you avoid it?
So basically they're called Zoom bombs, and it's like photo bomb. People show up when they're not supposed to. And so what happens is in our lower school, we've been using Zoom the whole time, and we've used one password. So that way all the kids could remember it. It was really easy. Well, somewhere along the way, that same workflow was shared with the older teachers, you know, teachers of the older kids. And so they tried to think, oh, I'll just give them a simple password. And then they weren't reading the names of the people. The kids were allowed to change their name. So, you know, as long as those certain features are ticked or unticked, you're able to have a lot more control. But that was a trial by fire type situation. And so we basically just had to move to if your video's not on and your real name is not there, you're going to have to be excused from the class kind of thing in an email sent home. But yes, when people show up and they start making comments or chatting or doing private chats and things like that, which are inappropriate. So that's been the issue.
And the other question I want to ask you as well is, you mentioned Seesaw, both of you actually as well. Now, could just, again, for people who don't know what Seesaw is, could you give an overview of Seesaw and why it's good for younger grades? Like, what's the reason schools are specifically using that, and why is it good in this kind of distance learning environment?
Can I kick that back to Tim? Because I think he knows a lot more about how that works. So I'm going to go back to Tim on that one.
I'm going to hit it straight back to them. So it's basically, it's a student learning journal portfolio. What we really like about it is it connects the student with the classroom, but also the parent can get involved as well. So there's that three that's three access points then. So as a teacher, you've got access to all your students. As a student, you have access to your class and your teacher. And as a parent, then you've got access to just your child as well. It's worth noting that they can only access their own child. And what they can do then is, as a teacher, you can assign activities. You can modify the activities, you can save them in your own library for future use. Students then will, very, very similar to Google Classroom, where the students will access that activity, they'll submit it, and as a teacher then you can see it, you can share it with the rest of the students, they can submit work as groups. So it's very interactive. And it's that kind of, for want to compare it, but it's in the idea of, it's like a Facebook, it's a journal, everything's posted chronologically, it's got like buttons, it's got comments. So it's kind of that interface that students are used to, parents are used to.
You've described, it sounds like Classroom pretty much. Is there a reason why?
Yeah, it's a little bit more intuitive for the younger students.
Right.
Like there's a massive green plus sign to post work, and there's no stream, classwork, Google Drive, that kind of links, that kind of thing. But it's a great progression tool then. So when you do, you can, we have grade two using both. So there's a crossover there. Then when they get to grade three, then they leave Seesaw behind and stuff.
Great. Great. Should we jump onto Nicole and what your kind of story has been with the shutdowns?
Yeah, for sure. So in the Middle East, we were sitting looking at Asia going, that's frightening, but we're okay. So the beginning of February, we were kind of watching everyone over there. And then February 25th, we were told everything's closed. So we had 24 hours to move online. So it was a really quick flip. So it came in, there was a religious event in Iran. And so they think that's where it came in from. And the first person diagnosed was a bus driver, a school bus driver. So they acted pretty fast and it went, boom, shut down. So we'd had a meeting before. So we did know that we were going to go through Google Classroom for the upper grades, really similar to what everyone's discussed. Lower grades until grade two do Seesaw, but that was about it. And so it's been a little bit of a, it's been a big learning curve, but it's pretty impressive to see how far people have come and even how far the kids have come. We used Google a lot in the classroom, but not to this extent. So it's been interesting to see how much they've improved. And then, yeah, learning more about Seesaw. My kids don't use Seesaw. We used it last year in my old school. But the differences are interesting. I'm a Google Classroom fan, but I think for the younger kids, it just, Seesaw is a lot easier. It's very visual. It's easy to see. So, yeah.
Cool. I'm curious what people think about schools who, obviously you guys all were using Classroom and a few other Seesaw and a few other online tools beforehand. Like a lot of schools weren't. And there was an email went out last week from the Department for Education in England to all schools recommending they use Google or Microsoft basically and giving some links. And we're involved in apps events and helping with a virtual staff room, which is like a drop-in for senior leaders in England. You know, who can ask any questions. But how do you think schools, like who weren't ready, do you think, could you get Classroom up and running when schools close? Like, so you're starting from a completely online environment. Like, obviously schools can do it, but what do you think of the challenges? Like, how do you think, you know, schools would go about that when, you know, you're bringing this in and the school is already closed? Yeah. Hi, Jason. Yeah. You're muted, I think.
Yep, sorry about that. You know, Dan, that's a really great question because I think a lot of schools in North America, that happened to, I think. Yep. A lot of them thought, oh, this is never going to affect us or whatever. So if they were already using Google tools, I would think that, you know, shifting over and having the single sign-in and kind of giving a quick overview probably wouldn't be too bad with older students. But, you know, and then it comes back to those what kids have access to at home, you know, and do they have reliable internet? Do they have, you know, a device that they can even access? And so I think, I think it probably wouldn't be too bad if you're already using in a Google ecosystem, already using, you know, email and the different docs. I think it probably would be okay. But I think adopting that and you haven't been using it very, you know, any of the other Google Suite stuff would be really, really challenging. I don't know what everyone else thinks, but what would you say, guys?
Yeah, I mean, my opinion is, I'm curious, the rest of you, my opinion is it's challenging from a training point of view if you don't have someone on your staff like who can really train, you know, get people up to speed. Because I think most of the stuff is quite easy for this, for the students. Most students have a personal Gmail account. They can figure out Classroom, you know. I think it's the challenge is, like, you've got to do something like this. You've got to train your teachers on a Google Meet, and you've got to have someone on staff or someone external who can come in and really get everyone up to speed. And I think that is kind of probably the challenge of doing this.
If I can add to that as well, I think that the challenge is, we're talking about rolling out to students, is also rolling out to staff as well. So, I mean, yes, we need to get Google Classroom up and running with students. But first of all, I suppose you've got to train your staff. I know a few schools actually in Europe who've had to roll out whole G Suite Enterprise, G Suite Education then remotely. So they've had to get that all set up. They've had to train someone as an administrator to set that up. Then they've had to go down the levels and then they have to get the staff up and running and roll it out to students. Yep. Sharing usernames and passwords. What email address do they send stuff to? Are they sending it to the parents? Do they send it to a student as a student? And that gets even more difficult then when you go down into a primary, elementary school where there is more support needed.
Yep.
But it's an eye opener as well, isn't it? That I think schools will definitely be better prepared after all of this.
Yeah, well, we talked about that on the previous podcast. That is a silver lining, is that, you know, schools have realized that, you know, it's you know, they need to have some sort of online web-based strategies. I mean, it's kind of obvious to us, I guess, because we live in this world, but it is useful. And of course, everyone's saying now, well, look, online is no substitute for in-person, which is of course true. But, you know, a lot of these tools which people are using in the lockdown are perfectly good tools to use in a regular school environment to enhance teaching and learning as well. So Nicole, I think you had something to say as well.
Yeah, I was just going to say, in primary school, where there's been the biggest learning gaps are things the kids that they don't know how to submit an assignment. And you think, oh, you can kind of build, say, a Screencastify video to show them how to do that. But they're also like in this anxiety bubble right now where simple things are really hard. It's trying to not only like, oh, how do I teach, say, an adult how to do that or a kid, but now online, and simplify it even further. So I think that's the big thing, is like, how do you scale it back and make it so easy a kid who's panicking, a 10-year-old, is like, oh, I can do this. I can submit it.
Yeah. While we're talking about tools, we actually have a live question from Cleft Asunder is the name. Has anyone got any experience of teaching with HyperDocs? Anyone used HyperDocs? No.
HyperDoc being a very long document with links to subsections and so on.
Yep. Yeah. Any experience? Anything to comment? Yeah.
Nicole? Yeah. So I do a newsletter at the beginning of the week that goes to parents and kids. And so all of their tasks or assignments are hyperlinked into that. And so I found that's a good, like, having a one-stop shop for it, because on Classroom it gets streamed, like it just keeps going. So this, for the parents and just for them to organize and time manage, was a little bit easier. It takes hours to set up because you have to have everything pre-planned for the week. And it's hard to be able to adjust based on the kids' needs if it's all there. But yeah, like my read alouds, boom, 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 they're all hyperlinked in. So simplified.
That's one of the things I think is, like, you've got to shift your mindset when you move to Google Docs, is just learning to search for things. Because when I was in the old world of you know, folder structures and stuff, you know, you get used to knowing where something is. But, you know, now I don't even file anything in Docs and Drive. The search functionality is so good, it will search for text inside of a document. So I can always find what I need. And I think, you know, schools that are kind of new to it, they haven't quite embraced the chaos of Dev Docs and knowing how to find it. I don't know if you guys have got any thoughts about that.
With the HyperDocs, I mean, only the other week when you had that online summit, the Apps Events Summit, I did a session about the a HyperDoc, basically, that you can export as a PDF.
Yep.
Or publish it as a website, and publish it to site, and then you can then integrate that into CSER or Google Classroom. So we've been using them, and you can put links to the Google Meet session at 10 a.m. This is the video I want you to watch. This is the activity I want you to do. And here's a slide deck that I want you to edit. And the slide deck is made to copy, so it's in each individual student. So that's something we've actually, in the last month, so only recently, we've started to look at using them, because it's making it easier for students and parents. It's just this one PDF or this one link that they go to, and that has their schedule then. So it took, like Nicole said, it takes some time to set it up, but that first one, second one's easier, third one, because you can just start using the templates.
Yeah.
But it's definitely an investment, actually, because it does make it a lot easier for parents and students then to navigate.
Sure. Great. Cool. Yeah, before we get on to reopening, plans for reopening and thinking about that, I want to just mention that IB pretty quickly. I know because we've got Jason on, who's I've discovered is a assessor or examiner. What's your role in there?
I have several roles, but basically I'm part of what's called the IBEN network, which is the IB Educator Network. And so yeah. I do workshops and things like that, and visits and consult for schools and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and so what's like a quick summary of how schools are handling the from an IB point of view now? We talked about predictive grades. Is there anything schools are needing to do now? And do you think there's any plans they're going to have to make for the future to deal with this in case it happens again?
Yeah, I think that because the predicted grades are going to have a lot more prominence in what ends up being the grade that the IB recognizes for our DP students. Additionally, the internal assessments, which are usually factored into their grade, is also taking a lot larger prominence in what's happening. So I think it will kind of reshift people's focus on just teaching to, you know, to give information and to do the exam versus much more about, you know, let's look at the holistic experience the student has in the class, and let's truly prepare them to know to really understand the knowledge versus just preparing them for paper one, paper two, paper three kind of thing. And so I do think that's already been the discussion, at least at my own school, is, oh, wow, I didn't realize the IA was going to be so important. I didn't realize this or that, which has always been important. But I think because the exams have always had the lion's share of, you know, where the grades come from or the marks come from, that's where people focus. You know, you just play the odds, right? And so, but yeah, that's what schools are doing as far as the DP goes. There's some other provisions they're making in like the MYP and things like that, but the high stakes would be in those DP courses and how schools are preparing for that. But the IB's done a lot of work. They've, in fact, this web, you know, the podcast we first did, part one was featured in the distance learning guide from the IB. So well done, Dan. I don't know who you know there, but good job, man. But yeah, so, you know, so they've done a really good job of staying ahead of it. They have a daily update that comes out on their website. And so, and they've even moved to a virtual visits model. And so schools who've been preparing to either have an evaluation visit or a verification visit or a consultant visit, they're actually doing them through through online means, through Google Meet or through Skype or through Zoom or things like that. So they still have an agenda. They still have the same groups meet, but instead of doing like a school tour in person, they have a virtual tour, you know? And so that's going to also be quite prominent in the future, I think. And it actually opens up a lot of doors for hard to get to areas where sometimes it's hard for them to find people who will go to these schools and visit because it's so hard to get a visa or whatever. I can see them starting to have like hybrid setups for these schools.
Great. And what about the other, anyone had any experience of any of the other examination systems, IGCSEs or anything, and how that's been dealt with? No. What do you, James, in Thailand? What you're doing the Thai? I guess you're doing the Thai system in your school, aren't you?
Yeah, so we're kind of on a blended model. A lot of our students go on to take the AP exams, register for AP, or they register for A levels as well. Depends on where they want to go to college. So they have very much open to them what they want to do at the end. We study a core curriculum, and then we'll prepare them for each of those strands. Right now, I think they are postponing the examinations, but nothing's finalized.
Yeah.
Sorry, James. I read somewhere that the AP were going to, especially in our time zone here, they were still running the exams at like 2 a.m.
Yeah, I read that.
Did you hear that? Yeah. I mean, we don't do it, so I just wondered.
Could well be that they're scheduled to take the exams at 2 o'clock in the morning online.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I read somewhere that was the plan.
Yeah,
interesting.
But given that things are changing so rapidly, that may revert back to live exams.
Yeah.
We'll see.
I mean, just in the last few weeks, everything is like, we wake up Monday morning, we talk about Google Meet, we've done all these updates, Jason mentioned it. There's something new going on every week, and it's, and with, especially the tools. So, I mean, We have time to keep us on our toes, basically, to see what's working. And then the students are doing that when it comes to security, things like that and everything. So I've never been involved in a situation that's literally changing weekly, yeah, if not daily.
So let's talk about the history, because obviously Google Meet, there's a lot of premium features such as, you know, which recording meetings, which is only available in enterprise for education. And Google gave that, you know, for the current period, gave it free to all schools. And then secondly, they just pushed out all the features really quick because they suddenly had an insane, I mean, when I talk to people at Google, they have an incredible number of people now, schools moving to Google. And so it was like literally the fastest development process I've seen in any Google product of all these new features coming online. And you're right, like every day you look and something's changed, you know, and it's really, I mean, I think there's several years worth of development I've gone into Meet in a month easily.
They've been great with feedback as well. I mean, I don't know another platform or another organization where you can offer some sort of feedback. Either they'll respond to you, even if it's been saying they can't do it, but no, more often than not, if you put some sort of feedback in, you'll see within a few weeks' time, yeah, something seems to happen.
Definitely. So I want to talk a bit about plans for reopening, like, and again, go around you guys, like how are you thinking? And then afterwards, we'll talk a bit about, you know, future plans for how things will be changed. You know, what's going to be different? Is there going to be a plan, you know, plans in place? But in terms of reopening, obviously, we were talking before, and Tim was saying about how, you know, a lot of it's just the Hong Kong government or whatever government just tells you when you're going to reopen. But obviously, there's some different strategies of how you're reopening. So anyone got any comments to say about how you're planning to come in again? Is it staged with teachers coming in? And then students, or how's it all been planned for? Do you want to jump off first?
Yeah, so just update here. Macau is opening their schools next week, which is right near the border, right near Hong Kong. And then just over the border in China, schools are opening this week. So I think Hong Kong are going to be monitoring their progress there and see how that goes. So I do think we'll be back sooner rather than later now. So I do think there's a bit of a light at the end of the tunnel here in Hong Kong. And then the rumors again, Steph, what we're reading online is it'll be staggered then. So it'll be a high school first, then a middle school, then an elementary. Elementary with us will probably run out of time to come back before the summer. So elementary probably looking now like especially lower elementary, and potentially be a next academic year now. And that's what they're looking at doing. As staff then, we're staggering staff back in as well. The school's been great when it comes to hygiene. We put in the heat sensors for temperature, and then we've got masks being, if anybody doesn't have a mask, they're handing out masks, all the hand sanitizers and things like that, getting everything in place just to add that reassurance. But then, as you said, then it's government's recommendation, government's advice. We'd be taking that then.
And are you planning, is there going to be any more spacing of students and things, or is it going to be the normal classroom?
It will go down to, again, government's advice at the moment. I think if there is some sort of social distancing requirement, schools won't open because it's just so hard to keep students apart. So I think, first of all, it's a whole society, and I think at schools will be the last thing they do open. But I think the whole climate's changed, hasn't it, globally, as in everyone's going to be Hong Kong now. I can almost see us adopting masks permanently. Really? Yeah, I mean, after we had SARS 15, 20, 25 years ago, when you visited Hong Kong, Dan, you see people wearing masks. We're now everybody. Literally, I came into school today, and on the way, I didn't see anybody not wearing a mask. And I do think that will continue for the foreseeable future, at least for another winter, a couple of winters anyway, for the flu seasons.
Yeah, well, I live in the Republic where there's no history of wearing a mask, and every single, I mean, they brought in law and everyone follows it, every single person wears it. It's kind of weird to see. Sorry, James.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's not just the history of SARS, but if you think, I know the Korea and Hong Kong get hit the same as Thailand by horrific air pollution between sort of November through to March. And so in Thailand, everybody was wearing a mask already. So when the coronavirus hit, people already had masks in stock. And then the same in Hong Kong and Korea, right? I mean, Jason,
James, pretty bad pollution. James, yeah. you had some school closures, didn't you, in Thailand as well, because of pollution beginning of this year, was it?
Yeah, so we were already, depending on the level, and if it goes over 150, outdoor activities are canceled, 200. We have different levels, and eventually school closure, yeah. We can't all work in schools like Chadwick, Jason. So Chadwick, they have negative health pressure thing, I think, right?
Yeah, we Chadwick has got a lot of things going for it. We have a really, really strict air quality index thing that we follow. So 4 or 5 times a day, they check it with their own hand sensors, plus these stations around the school. And if they hit a certain point, they start limiting outdoor play and things like that. And it's quite low. The threshold's quite low. And the lower school teachers complain a little bit because it's like these kids need to get, which, you know, you're weighing the health benefit of keeping kids inside and not playing versus breathing in this whatever. But, you know, in the we have the extra thing here in South Korea of our neighbors to the north. And so there's other procedures in place for if something were to happen. So folks here have been living with 60, 70 years of what's going to happen, kind of on the edge of their seat. And so I think that's one reason South Korea has been so ready to roll with this, is that they really have, everyone kind of follows the rules. You know, they tell them, okay, you need to give them 2 meters and everyone will get out and do it, you know, and the masks are the same thing, but it's starting to warm up here and less people are wearing them outside. When you go inside, everyone's wearing them, but outside people are trying to get more fresh air and to try to kind of stay, you know, more fit. And so, but you know, for us, the Ministry of Education is really driving this whole thing. And so they have a couple of markers that they're looking at. One is that there's a certain number of cases for a consistent number of days, like it has to be below a certain number. And then also they survey the parents and the teachers, and they all have to pretty much agree that it's okay to go back to school. So they actually ask the parents and they ask the teachers, are you comfortable going back to school? So that's the next step, is once we get to a certain point, then, okay, is everybody okay with us going back to school? And then the final step is, well, then here's the procedures your school has to follow in order to be allowed to be open. So there's like, it's kind of a 3-prong approach. That's from the external sources that we have. But then within our own school, we've just started the conversation of what's it going to look like when we start back up. So I don't really have much to add on that, except we're having that discussion. We're beginning that discussion.
Sure. Nicole, anything to add from your side?
Yeah, similar. We've just started Ramadan here, so that will change things drastically. People will start to kind of not follow social distancing rules as much, because culturally, like, they get together in huge, massive family groups at the end of the day. So I think the government's waiting to kind of see how the numbers spike after this. And then I think we'll be on close until at least after Ramadan. But we really, yeah, same thing. We're at the mercy of the Ministry of Education. And until they say go, go. I think our schools made a couple like plans depending on what could happen. But we really have no idea. And I don't know that we'll be open this year. But yeah, we'll see.
Talking about the future, because obviously, you know, it's if something bad happens in life, it's always good to have a plan to deal with it a second time so you can do better. So I want to talk a bit about what you guys are thinking of for your schools, and also what you suggest to other schools in terms of having a strategy. Now we know that, you know, this could happen again, coronavirus could happen again. And if not, you know, I think every school should have a strategy for dealing with closures, because something else could happen. And now it's happened. People are aware of it. I actually had a question from Jane, who we work with. When your schools reopen, do you plan to hold regular classes or modify them in any way? So that's a good question. Like, do you think school, I mean, Tim mentioned, you know, possibly social distancing laws and stuff, but do you think there's anything that's come from this online world that's going to lead schools to modify the way classes are taught? No, I mean, I guess I'll kick off. I think one thing is, you know, Classroom, a lot of schools are using Google Classroom and they're probably going to take that into their, when they reopen. I don't know if anyone's got any more thoughts about that.
You just jump in there. I've seen a couple of images of schools preparing their facilities for a return to school. Have you seen, actually, out of Korea, from Rob School, who we all know, they have these perspex cubicles around the eating areas of public spaces. I don't know where the image came from, but maybe you saw it on social media, all of the students in the face masks and the visor as well, in addition to social distancing. So I think there's a few ideas floating around there about modifying the physical space.
You know what surprised me? This is more of a general point, not a school point, but just how quickly things adapt. Like, so in Prague, all of a sudden, you know, they said that restaurants could serve food for takeaway. So all of a sudden, everyone in their front door of the restaurant made a kind of special counter with a Perspex window face to face. Every news agent, every small shop had a special custom Perspex thing. And this happened in like almost overnight, 2 or 3 days. Everyone had these things built and the whole kind of retail experience had changed in the country, you know. And it just amazed me how quickly people adapt, you know, to these things. It's just, it was kind of a weird observation. So coming back, what about planning and anything else about how schools can plan? Should schools make like a disaster plan and a strategy so, you know, they can deal with it quickly in the future?
Yeah. Can I add something to what you said? And I think it goes along with what you've just asked, is that one thing we're considering is building in asynchronous school days. Like one every quarter where the teachers are still reporting to school and they're still working, but the kids stay home and they do some flipped learning and they do some things. And I think by building up that tolerance, I guess you could say, or continuing to work that muscle, we'll just get more and more streamlined with it. So if this happens or when this happens again, it's not as foreign, it's not as unusual, right? And so I do know that we already built all kinds of handbooks and things that have all the stuff inside saying, here's what happens if this happens. Here's the procedure we have for that. But a lot of it's been quite, as my colleague called it, it's like a triage sort of building, you know, like they've built up this to respond. It's a response versus being proactive and having a true plan, you know? And so I think that's what we hope forward, is that we'll have a plan versus just reaction.
Definitely.
To add to that then, Jason, we've all started discussions about induction next year that we're gonna put in some time. We're looking at the calling it like school closure plan, be it for a typhoon, be it for protests or something like this again. Also if staff are absent as well, if they're off on some sort of PD for a couple of days. So we're basically, that would be looked around Google Classroom and the ecosystem there. So we just build on the skills. Our teacher's been absolutely amazing as it is, but now let's take advantage of this now and let's get everybody up to date on the tools. We were only talking this morning as well, updating devices, ensuring all devices are up to date, because you'd be surprised, just a handful go through that they haven't been updated, the apps are up to date and all that kind of thing. So just ensuring that infrastructure, and that's not just tool resources, human resource and everything, everybody's actually prepared then. And you mentioned practice days, and I've heard other schools mention that as well, as they're going to call it a drill kind of thing. And then just if this does come around, like the typhoon season is the example we're using in September, October, if we have a couple of days closed there, then we can just continue. And if a teacher's absent, they know 7:30 in the morning, the students also, not just the teachers, students know the drill. They know 7:30 in the morning, they go on to Google Classroom. Here's the activities, here's assignments. Sorry, this is what you need to do then. So everybody's aware of the expectations if there is closure.
And what you mentioned devices, Tim. I think this whole closure thing is a huge reason to use Chromebooks, to be honest. If you think of like how easy it is to manage them remotely for the tech director of a school to manage, you know, to remotely troubleshoot and fix Chromebooks and how simple it is, I think a lot of schools have said this has just been a great use case of the simplicity of Chromebooks.
I mean, it has highlighted not mistakes, but it has highlighted some weak points that we may have in schools and everything, and where we need to maybe improve on. But the challenge then as well is, as James mentioned earlier, about internet access for students. And they say even governments now need to well, like 100 years ago, they wanted everybody to get electric. Well, now it's they want everybody to get internet access and decent internet access. So we are better prepared if something like this does happen.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, you know, we are talking about international schools here, and we're all aware that a lot of schools, you know, are much less privileged situation and don't have the kind of access that students in your schools do. Got anything else, James?
Yeah, just jump in there. Interestingly, the Thai government arranged for 10 gigabytes of mobile data to be issued to everybody across Thailand. So obviously for those families without broadband access, they've all, you know, most families do have a smartphone in the family. So at least they had some internet access. 10 gigabytes will go a long way to provide learning through that. So it's a pretty proactive thing to do, especially in a country like Thailand, where there is massive inequity in access.
Yeah.
And actually, just a secondary question to something Jason was mentioning earlier, because I know that Chadwick does a lot of parental outreach. So I wonder how parent conferences, parent trainings, parent meetings, and so on, how they supported in your transition to online learning. For Jason first, and then anybody else.
Coming. Sorry. Go ahead, Nicole.
We just finished up parent conferences and did them all online, and progress reports all online. Mm. Tim helped me immensely with being able to book them and do that all privately. Mm. Thank you, Tim. Save my butt. But it was a totally different experience than having them in the classroom. Mm. And a lot of ours are student led. And so for me as a teacher, trying to get that out of my student through a webcam was incredibly difficult. But parents that in the Middle East, I don't know if it's just here, but like typically I won't meet fathers, but more of the family got involved because it was at home. So it was really cool to be able to see the parents, everybody, even the little kids and the cat and the dogs. You got to kind of connect with your kids and their entire family a lot better. And there was something really nice about it. But yeah, we did them all completely online, which was hard to set up, but we did it.
Yeah, we've actually used StreamYard. So after doing a few of those live streams with Thirsty PD and those guys, you know, we use StreamYard, and then that allows parents to write questions, and then you can pop them up on the screen, and then everyone sees them and that kind of thing. So, we've been using the recording studios for that, James. So that way they have a nice quiet space to work. And so we've done that, but we also just this last week hosted our, PYP exhibition, and we did it through Zoom. And so there was a StreamYard live session where everybody was told what to do. And then there was a PDF sent out with all the codes and the passwords for each of the rooms. And then you went in and you could, and they had these like rotations. So each group did it twice. And so people were able, and they recorded them. So that way you could still see them. And there was a lot of electricity. The kids were really excited. It was a really good event. And so I think that, you know, I do think it will open up people's horizons when it comes to what options there are out there for when, like you said, Tim, when there's PD going on or when there's this or that going on. There are all kinds of chances for, you know, folks to use these sort of tools that they probably dabbled with before that have now become indispensable, you know, in their daily life. And so, but yeah, we use StreamYard, and we've been really happy with that actually and that setup.
Just want to, Daniel asked a really good question, which relates exactly what Jason just mentioned. What skills and dispositions are your teachers and students learning and developing that you want to sustain and build when school on campus resumes? Do you want to add anything to your, because I think you kind of answered that, Jason.
Yeah, thank you. Even listening, my son's in grade 5, so he was doing the PYP exhibition, and to hear his reflection, he just kept talking about having to use time management skills and all that, which are things we want to hear them say anyway. But the collaboration skills, they met every single day for an hour on Zoom. So they figured out how to use it. They were telling me things to do. So I think they're a lot less camera shy than maybe they were prior to this. So even something like Flipgrid was sometimes a challenge for my students, where now just being on camera and things like that, they're much more comfortable doing that. So I think working in a remote environment is something they're a lot more comfortable with. And that's a good skill, because that's a skill that they're going to have into adulthood, because that's, the world's getting smaller and smaller, and this is how we're starting to communicate.
Yep, definitely. Nicole?
I was going to say the creativity, the idea that you can use tech to build or create or kind of show what you know. I think my kids have advanced drastically, and I don't want to lose that. So they have all these different mediums now, and they're able to make a video, or even like Jason was saying, connect with each other and bounce ideas off each other online. And they know how to do that independently. That's not something my grade fives really had. And so figuring out how to embed that into the classroom and bring that technology and integrate it. So it's not just you have tech class or you're doing this to learn this tech skill, but like, how do you use it to create? That's what I kind of want to keep going with my kiddos.
Great. I think we have another question from Daniel Gordon. Do you want to bring it up, James, on using your admin skills? Cool.
What systems and structures other than the practice days are you considering putting in place to sustain and build the skills and dispositions that have emerged during this experience?
I'll be happy to start. I know that one thing we've discussed is having a much more formal process of flipping the classroom, having it be part of what we're doing, because there were teachers who were already flipping the classroom due to whatever reasons, whether it was time constraints or just whatever. But I think it will become part of the whole experience that the students have from pre-K to 12 now, you know, is that it'll become part of what they do on a regular basis, and not call it homework, but call it pre-work or something like that. Like this idea that they can watch something the day before and then come into class ready to talk about it versus the traditional sitting and listening type situation. But I know that the flipped classroom, as far as the teachers go, those are the kind of structures that they're asking for. And I think screencasting is part of that. But I've seen a lot of really good work from teachers that aren't comfortable with that have really shined with doing that. And they've really enjoyed the medium. So a lot of them are asking lots of good questions.
Yeah, great point about flipped classroom. And this has been a huge kind of global experiment in using flipped classrooms, hasn't it? Which is that's one thing to say about the whole crisis.
I'll jump in there. So I work closely with staff for the teachers. So I've answer it more from that angle, where there's been so much collaboration and communication between teachers, be it within our school but also globally. Basically everybody's really stepped up the plate to share things, to help things, support each other. So we'd look to continue that basically. And we make more scheduled time to meet with teachers to discuss technology use, more opportunity to share practices. Your demo slams and things that you do at apps events, we'll have them now internally, like once a month, I'm doing this. So again, it does seem to be a lot of enthusiasm from teachers about using technology and using it meaningfully. So be able to channel that now and continue that even when we come back into a classroom environment then.
Definitely. Well, I think that's a great place to finish actually on a high note. And so I want to thank you guys for coming, from all across Asia and the Middle East. It's been a good chat. Anyone who watches this afterwards, please, there's a chat. You can put your questions in there. We'll jump in and ask them. Thanks very much to Daniel and Cleft and someone called Too Confused to Put a Name, who commented on Jason's beard.
Being very nice. Thank you.
Great. So thanks very much, guys, and look forward to the next show.
Thanks, Dan.
Cheers, Dan. All the best, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Guys.